Okay, well, what I'd like to do is begin by stating that this is the 9th of April 2010, and I'm in the office of Professor Brandy Munson at the University of Delaware, and we're going to do a little oral history recording of his career in chemistry and mass spectrometry more specifically. So I think with that little detail out of the way, we can go ahead and get started. And really the first thing that we like to start in is the beginning. And the beginning is your birth date and what part of the country you were born and a little bit about your parents.
I was born on March 20th, 1933. I was born in Wharton, Texas, W-H-A-R-T-O-N, and with reasonable certainty I was born in a hospital there. I grew up there. I went to high school there. I graduated in 1950. Wharton was a small town then and is a small town now. There were 50 people in my high school graduating class. Huge.
And where's Wharton with respect to some place that we could identify with
Wharton
Texas?
Wharton is about 60 miles southeast of Houston. It's on the Texas Gulf Coast.
I was saying, you're getting close to the coast. Then.
Yeah, it is. Well, the other thing, which doesn't work now but did for a while, was that we were roughly 15 miles from the Texas Gulf Sulfur Company, which was the largest frosh sulfur mine in the world.
Frosh?
Taking the sulfur metal, sulfur ore, and melting it.
So frosh.
R-A-S-C-H.
R-A-S-C-H.
That's the ore.
Oh, okay.
And this is the sulfur block that the Texas Gulf Sulfur Company used to give at county fair.
So it looks like it's kind of pretty well intermingled with a
yes,
hard,
it is a rock, but
a hard rock.
That's pure sulfur that's in the rock. That's a low-grade ore that's there. But it was great fun.
So you had an experience with the sulfur thing in your youth, or...?
Not really. I went over there and looked at it, but that was about it.
What about your parents and their educational level? That's an important piece of information that helps.
Both my father and my mother graduated from the University of Texas in Austin, and that was back in the days when it was considered the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
My father may have gotten his undergraduate degree someplace else, but he got his law degree at the University of Texas in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was in school there at the time. My grandfather got his law degree from the University of Texas. I think my great-grandfather did. But I'm the black sheep in the family. My father was a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer. My great-grandfather was a lawyer. And I'm a chemist.
Okay. When your mother graduated, that was not common, was it, for women to go through a bachelor's degree program?
I don't know how common it was at the time. She did, and her sister did. My grandmother went to college. Going to college wasn't uncommon. Subsequently going to college in chemistry was.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I graduated from the University of Texas in 1954, I remember only two or three women in class.
Mm-hmm.
In the class. There may have been more, but I remember very few.
Mm-hmm. So it would have been in the 20s that your mother graduated, probably.
Yes.
And yeah. She, what was the degree that she took, do you know, or...?
It was just sort of a general bachelor's degree because she was the librarian in the high school.
Okay. And what were your parents' names?
Milam Stephen Munson, Jr. And my mother's name was Emily Elizabeth Burnaby. And so I'm Milam Stephen Burnaby Munson to make the distinction between me and all the other Milam Stephen Munsons that are around.
So you elected to go by Burnaby?
I don't know that I elected to. You don't really have that much choice is what you're called when you're growing up. But that was to make the distinction in there. But when I was growing up, I was little Stephen, Burnaby, Bub, Bubba, you name it. I and even these days I answered almost anything, probably including KU.
And so basically, there is quite a bit of education in your family's background.
Yes.
So I guess when it came time for you to move on from high school, it was pretty much an assumption that you would go to college.
Oh, yes. It was absolutely established that I would go to college. What I was going to do in college, I have the vaguest idea. And my way of comment along that line is, when I started going to college in 1950, it was not a federal case.
Mm-hmm.
We did not spend the summer looking at a dozen schools.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we didn't look at any. Mm-hmm. I got information from a whole bunch. I went to a junior college in Texas, Central Texas, John Tarleton. I can't remember whether it was John Tarleton Agricultural College then or whether it was Tarleton State College in there, but it was a junior college. It was 2 years. I wasn't taken and dumped there, but we really didn't consider. We didn't weren't concerned about where I went. I had a cousin who was teaching there in the agronomy department, which was not what I had any interest in.
Yeah.
And my sister had gone there for 2 years, so I went. And I enjoyed it. It was great fun.
And where was this located?
It's in Stephenville.
Stephenville,
which is southwest of Fort Worth. Oh, about maybe an hour southwest of Fort Worth.
Okay, you're pretty much in the middle of the state then.
Yeah. Back then, it was a long way. There. And when I went to school, I had no idea what I was going to major in. But nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
I took a general liberal arts course the first year. I took chemistry because everybody took chemistry. I took algebra rather than calculus because only engineers took calculus.
Mm-hmm.
If Tarleton had been a 4-year school, I probably would have gotten a degree in political science or history and become a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a 2-year school, and I transferred to the University of Texas in 1952. And I obviously had some interest in chemistry then, because the first semester that I was there, I was taking courses half in chemistry and half in history, something like that. Why I did, I don't know. Where I developed an interest in chemistry is absolutely beyond me.
So you didn't do the classic childhood chemistry set thing?
I had a chemistry set when I was growing up, but I didn't do anything significant with it.
You didn't hurt yourself with it.
I didn't kill myself. And that was at the time that a reasonable number of mostly boys, I suspect, did get hurt making rockets. I didn't make rockets. I was sort of a coward and didn't have anybody helping me, and so I had a good high school chemistry course, unfortunately I can't remember the teacher's names, which I liked, but there was nothing set. I didn't have anything special. And in 52, when I started at Austin, I was taking a analytic geometry course in the pure math department, which was the worst course I had ever taken in my entire life. I had no interest in this thing. I worked hard in that course. I couldn't understand any reason for doing it. Subsequent courses were in the applied math department, which was fine. But I took quant.
Mm.
And quant had 2 lectures a week, meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. It had 6 hours of lab a week for each semester. My recollection is that we had a quiz once a week, beginning at 8 o'clock, short quiz.
Mm-hmm.
If you were late, you had a few minutes less to take the quiz. Gilbert Ayers was the instructor.
Think so, last name?
A-Y-R-E-S, I think. Gilbert Haven Ayers.
Mm-hmm.
Classical analytical chemistry. Inorganic chemistry of rock. First semester was quant, the first semester was gravimetric analysis, the second semester was volumetric analysis. The number of people in the class was limited by the number of balances, because these are these double pan balances, and you measured the weight, it took the average of five swings or whatever it was, and weighing anything was a nearly federal case. And it was your balance, and you were the only one who used that balance during that lab period. I don't know whether it was because of or in spite of that course that I decided to become a chemist. But then I continued on, and I got a BA rather than a BS. Not that it really made much difference, but the main reason was that the BS required German, and I had taken Spanish, and I didn't propose to take German.
So, with the BA from Austin, and that's in chemistry now.
Yes.
You have to decide on what's next in your career.
I've never planned well for anything. In my senior year, I was taking, I took organic and physical at the same time in my senior year in order to graduate. I graduated in 4 years. And I was doing well in people.
That was kind of challenging, wasn't it, both of those?
Yes.
In one semester, I mean, I said that organic and PCAM would be.
It was. Organic synthesis was not anything I was particularly good at. PCAM I did reasonably well in, and the professor who was teaching the course asked if I wanted to do some work in the lab. And I did. And he was studying Robin Anderson, R-O-B-B-I-N, Anderson with an O. And he was studying reactions of acetylene. And I was not quite, but close to a pyromaniac. And so this sounded like fun, and I did it. And if you take acetylene and put it in a pressure, atmosphere, something like that, you can get a flame in pure acetylene. It gives a tremendous amount of carbon, an awful mess, but the flame very slowly goes down the cylinder. And we were playing around with the effect of different chemical additives, parameters on the flame velocity and things like that. And so that sounded like fun. And then after I got my undergraduate degree, well, why not go to graduate school? It seemed like a reasonable thing to do. I didn't have anything I particularly wanted to do. So I then started working with Anderson on that. And the policy then, as it is in most places, you really shouldn't get all your degrees at the same place. So I was working to a master's degree and got a master's degree on thermal reactions of acetylene. And then I went and spent a year at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. My way of describing that was I've never been so cold before nor since in my life. The school was fine. I was working with John Margrave, high temperature inorganic chemistry. But there was no way I was going to live in that part of the country. That was it. I was there for one academic year, and I left, and I came back to Boston. That's fine.
So this acetylene experiment, what was the motivation for that? I mean, there was some underlying reason for doing these.
The Army was supporting that back in the days when they were supporting non-basic research, which had some relevance to it. It was the idea that acetylene was one of the intermediates in a lot of combustion reactions. And so this was then studying the reactions of acetylene. And that was what I wound up doing to get my PhD, my master's and PhD on thermal reactions of acetylene.
So you went back to work for the same fellow when you got back to Austin. And eventually that led to, 59.
I got a PhD in 59. I stretched it out as long as I could. But after a while, when people begin to ask, are you still here? You get the idea that perhaps you should finish. And again, then when I finished, I went to work for Humboldt. 59 was a good time to get a PhD because there were lots of job offers. I don't remember how many I had, but I had more than one. And it didn't really occur to me that I should go into teaching. You went to work for a living, and that was what I did. Why I chose Humboldt, I don't know. I was down to two places, Humboldt or Bratz.
Was it another petroleum
company? It was another oil company in Dallas. Mobil.
Oh, okay.
Mobil. And at Mobil, I knew what I would be doing and sort of interested in it. It was in situ combustion. As I said, I was a pyromaniac for secondary oil recovery. And, but Baytown, Humboldt, I didn't know what I was going to do. And as I said last night, at that time, they were not hiring people to do anything specific. They were hiring people.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to work, I think they decided what I was going to do shortly before I came. And I was on a project in solution thermodynamics, trying to extract paraffins from aromatics using fluorocarbon solvents. Well, it didn't work, but it was some solution thermodynamics about which I had no experience whatsoever, but fortunately had done a little bit of reading on Hildebrand solubility. It was fun, and I enjoyed it. I even got a paper out of it.
I want to back up a second. He had this kind of a black sheep career of going into chemistry. How did that go over with your lawyer family, legal?
My father never expressed an opinion as to what it was I should do.
As long as you got out and did your own thing, it was okay with him.
He never expressed an opinion. My grandmother was quite sure, however, that I was going to go to become a lawyer. But my father never expressed an opinion as to what it was that I was going to do.
So that was kind of nice that you could kind of follow your interests as you wished.
I never, as I said, my life does not display a tremendous amount of planning and obvious goals. This seemed interesting at the time, so I did it.
And they went along with it, so that was
that was.
So, other than the fact that there was really a strong background, strong interest in being an educated person in your family, they really didn't care what you did, as long as it was just understood that you would get the degree and proceed.
It was a given.
Okay.
It was a given.
So you then started at Humboldt in what have been
59. Yeah.
Humboldt Oil and Refining. That was a small outfit, I think. Was it
well, it was a small. Yes and no. It was the still called Humboldt, but it was owned mostly by Esso at the time. It had been a Texas oil company, and the refinery and the research center were there. And I don't know the exact ownership game, but at that time, we were connected with Esso Research and Engineering, but a lot of it was still autonomous in the research center in the Baytown refinery.
So Baytown was where they had their primary refinery?
Yeah, the Baytown refinery was one of them. There was another one up in Bayway in New Jersey, and there are other refineries. But the Humboldt refinery was in Baytown. And the research center was in the refinery, just sort of in a little bit of a corner of the refinery that was there.
So how did the research center support the refinery, or did it? Was there any interaction? I mean, did anything you did in the research center help the refinery? Or?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the research in the research center was associated with projects in the refinery, obviously. But at that time, Humboldt, and I suspect most companies, were doing different kinds of research. I didn't know anything about it when I went there, but Joe Franklin and a small group was doing really basic research in ion chemistry. The other projects were what called long-range research, in which there was no immediate goal, and then there were projects that were basically associated with things that were happening. We need something, an answer right now. And I think that the policy was generally that when somebody came in with a PhD, you would put them in a long-range project and then get them to convert them to you want to do something for the immediate benefit of the company. I worked on my solution thermodynamics project for a year or two. I don't really remember how long. And then Fred Lamp left to go to Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of Joe Franklin, Frank Field, and Fred Lamp, who had been doing ion chemistry. And I became Fred Lamp's replacement. My way of describing it is that I was Joe Franklin's first postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the leader of the group and the oldest in the group. But Frank and Fred were comparable age and stature. I knew nothing about mass spectrometry when I went into the group, mm-hmm. and said I was Joe's first postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
Why I was chosen, I don't know. I'm glad I was,
yeah.
because I've been doing it since 1962, maybe? 61 or 62, something like that. I think my first publication was in 62. On a really practical thing,
mm-hmm.
the reactions of rare gas atoms and rare gas ions.
Yeah, that was, you know, really, must have been useful to the petroleum industry.
Very.
So, Joe Franklin was kind of like an institution or a person of,
yes.
Of note in the organization there.
Yes, he was. I think a lot of things happened in the research center through Joe's insistence, through Joe's persuasion. That we had at that time lectures in science series, and these were notable chemists who would come in and would give, I think, a 2-week short course.
Oh, wow.
People would take them. I had an inorganic chemistry course with Eugene Rochow. Wasn't terribly related to anything that I was doing, but that was all right, I did it.
What was his, how do you spell that name?
Rochow, a noted inorganic chemist at the time. I had a 2-week course in irreversible thermodynamics with Ilya Prigozhin, which was also not closely related to anything that I was doing.
How do you spell that one?
Prigogine.
Prigo.
Prigo. Prigogine.
Okay. So who would attend these courses?
Different people in the research center. If you had an interest in it, you could do it. And there were maybe, you'd get maybe one a year or one every other year, something like that.
And
you
said these were 2 weeks long?
Yeah, these were 2 weeks, and you weren't doing anything else. You were doing that all day.
So, I mean, this was all-day lectures?
Well, it was lectures, discussions, problems, interactions going on with it. Sort of like the short course.
For 2 weeks?
Yeah, for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, they paid these individuals, obviously, to come in and do this.
Yes.
And you think Joe was behind getting...
Oh, I know he was.
Yeah.
He ran it.
Yeah. And so they did this approximately once a year, and how many years do you think this went on?
Right? I don't remember how many years it went on, but it went on for several, primarily because of Joe's insistence on it, with the idea that this would keep people up to date on new areas of science, other things that were going on. Because one of the things that you could see fairly easily was that if you were working on a specialized project, you became the company's expert on this, and you narrowed in, and that was what it was you did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the company decided they weren't interested in that anymore, which happened periodically,
mm-hmm.
then you were sort of out of it.
Yeah.
This was the idea of a continual training that was going on.
Trying to keep you from getting boxed in.
Trying to keep you from getting stale.
And so the number of how many people were in the research operation at Humboldt? Altogether,
I
think it would have been 20, 50?
50 to 100, something like that, but I really don't remember the number.
So a fairly large operation for what, Humboldt wasn't that big of a company, was it, at that time?
Well, it was a fairly hefty sized company because they had an awful lot of oil down there,
mm-hmm.
and it was still a huge refinery.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that time they were 250,000 barrels a day or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time we were part of, before that they'd been completely independent. Humboldt had been taken over by ESSO, mm-hmm. and we were then connected with ESSO Research and Engineering and would go up to New Jersey for periodic meetings.
Okay, so then ESSO had its own operation, but that was up on the East Coast.
Yeah, ESSO's lab, main labs were in Linden.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Baton Rouge lab, but main research was up in Linden.
Well, it seems like a very interesting thing that would be done, you know, in a really an industrial, I mean, petroleum company is really a heavy industry type operation, and they have a research group that would then bring in prominent scientists to lecture for 2 weeks. I mean, I can't imagine a modern company allowing someone to take off 2 weeks and to do...
to take well, unfortunately, I can't either anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's pathetic, but it shows a certain change in the mentality of how things are done in the corporate America.
Very much so. Very
compared
much so.
To
well, at that time, the Baytown Research Center was like a lot of companies, and if you went to work for them, you retired there. When I was interviewing at that time, companies talked about their retirement plans
mm-hmm.
with the idea that you would stay there for 40
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
And I staged, managed some 40-year parties, some retirement mm-hmm. parties mm-hmm. while I was there for people who'd been there and were going on for that
mm-hmm.
in the research center. I left in 67 to come to Delaware. And about that time, the company had the major change. They were having layoffs and
mm-hmm.
things that they had never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd never gone back to the original world.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat paternalistic, but it was fine.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there were people who, you went to work for the refinery, and you were going to stay there for the remainder of your
yeah.
work life.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously changed quite
a bit. Yes.
I don't know, maybe for the better or the worse, who knows? But it seemed that at least having a job in perpetuity, so to speak, if you, I assume that you had to perform, but...
Yes.
But, you know...
And there were people left, sometimes of their own volition, sometimes encouraged to leave. But nobody was ever really fired.
Mm-hmm.
If they left, it was... encouraged to go someplace else.
So you were drafted into this organization with Lamp Field and Franklin, and this was your first exposure to mass spectrometry.
Yes. At that time, mass spectrometers were relatively very expensive, and there weren't very many universities that had them. The University of Texas in Austin did not have one.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually had a little bit of indirect. A friend of mine who graduated a year before me was working down in Baytown in the research center. And he ran some mass spectra of some of the material, the pyrolysate
mm-hmm.
from acetylene, aromatic hydrocarbons, polynuclear ones, and so forth
mm-hmm.
and so on. So he ran the mass spectra, and we just sort of made some guesses to what the compounds were.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know anything at all about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, their mass spectrometry was not offered, was not discussed in my graduate analytical course that I recall
sure.
anything at all about.
No, no. So what kind of instrumentation were you faced with when you got into the group?
Frank Field had built, you talked with Frank, he had built, well, he didn't physically do it himself, but he had it built. A high-pressure mass spectrometer, which was a huge thing
mm-hmm.
in the lab. It took up the whole lab.
So by high pressure?
Oh, this was high pressure for mass spectrometry, and it began working with maybe... The ion chemistry began in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Tal Rosa, Stevenson and Schisler, and Field Franklin and Lamp were the three major groups.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them in petroleum refineries because they had the mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact sequence of the events. I think Tal Rosa actually did it first,
mm-hmm.
increasing the pressure in methane. And if you do that, then you see that the 17 to 16 ratio changes with pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And my way of describing it, Cal Rosa was a physicist, so CH5 plus seemed perfectly reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
CH5 plus has never seemed reasonable to any chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sort of went on. And Stevenson and Schisler were doing this. And
how do you spell Schisler?
S-C-H-I-S-S-L-E-R.
Two S's.
Yeah, they were at Shell Development in Emeryville. And so at that time, you took a standard mass spectrometer and just put two larger samples in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see these reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And analytically, it had happened before. If you put in two larger samples, you could see the M plus one ions for polar compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tried to build up the pressure deliberately. And Frank's instrument was designed to go to high pressures, to operate at high pressures with differential pumping.
Mm-hmm.
And the time I was there, we began with going up to pressures of 0.2 millimeter, 200 microns in the illicit units of the day.
Illicit units?
Yes.
200 microns?
200 microns. 200 microns. And at the low pressures, what you could see are the product ions. You could see mass 17 and mass 29 because there wasn't anything there in methane. At high pressures, you could see the product ions and you could see the reactant ions disappear.
Mm.
So you could study the kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case that you studied the kinetics by varying the abundance of the ion at essentially a constant time, because you couldn't vary the time much. You didn't have any. Did this with you had an electric field and it injected the ions. And so you got these funny looking curves. Catherine called them spaghetti curves. Reactant ions decreasing, product ions increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could match them and get the reactant product sequence by relative abundance and by measuring appearance potentials.
This is Catherine Finslow?
Oh, no, Catherine didn't have anything to do with this, but she called my things spaghetti curves.
Ah, okay.
And at 200 microns, you could see lots of reactions. You could see many things that were going on. And then later on, we increased the pressure to about 2 millimeters.
Mm.
And then you could see a lot more things that were going on.
Mm.
Now, to some extent, we were rediscovering what the physicists had learned a good while ago, and that is, if they were doing discharge experiments in gases, you get the products change at higher pressures.
Mm-hmm.
The products were not what you started out with,
mm-hmm.
and the effect of impurities were mm-hmm. very obvious
mm-hmm.
in that one, but we didn't really know that.
Not the first time that something has been rediscovered.
No, you're right.
So, were there any other mass spec instruments that you interacted with there besides this high-pressure piece here?
There were a couple of other instruments that were there, but I spent all my time. Oh, wait a minute. Stop.
So we were talking about other instruments besides the high pressure energy that you had.
There was a CEC 10X or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the early instruments that was used for routine analyses.
Mm-hmm.
I spent all my time with one mass spectrometer. I didn't get in to use that one. That one ran, technicians ran that, and it was used extensively for analyzing samples for the research center. I mean for the plant.
So it was in a research center environment, but it was kind of used for routine and analysis.
Yeah. For projects in the research center and for analyzing things in the plant. And then there was Earl Lumpkin was there, and he was using that, and Tom Excel, A-C-Z-E-L, was there.
Mm.
And they got an MS-9. I think that was the first MS-9 in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Doing high resolution analyses of samples in the research center and for the refinery. And I remember had a silographic paper with the multiple charts, multi-sensitive silographic paper. And I remember one of the technicians, whom I still see occasionally, Mary Frances Bonds, would be down this huge 20 feet of chart paper that came out, was slowly recording, and would take a ruler and would measure the peak heights for all the multiplets of a given peak, of a given mass number, for the analysis of the aromatic composition and the heteronuclear aromatic composition.
So it was a high-resolution scan.
Yes. High-resolution scan, very slow.
Yeah, supposed to be a ton of peaks to measure.
Oh, there were. There were.
Well, you know that one of the old CC-110s is up at Iowa in Ron Grigsby's basement, and he still does PONA analysis with it and, through his Petromass company.
Yes. The one that they had was not a 110.
Mm-hmm.
It was the earlier version, the low-resolution routine instrument.
Yeah.
That the petroleum companies have been using for years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there was this kind of analytical side that was separated from the stuff that you guys were doing in the research. So you interacted primarily with this high-pressure instrument.
Yes, that was my mass spectrometry.
So where did these publications go?
Journal of Chemical Physics, Journal of American Chemical Society, Journal of Physical Chemistry.
Okay. And so you're studying the chemistry of, you're studying ion chemistry.
Yes.
And so they accepted these publications without too much trouble?
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, there was a small but continuing ion chemistry group at the time. We started the first paper that I was worked with Joe and Frank on was, as I said, the reactions of rare gas atoms and rare gas ions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take an electric, if you get that discharge in it, you produce the rare gas, excited rare gas atoms, which will react, collide with, and react to form the dimer ion that are there, the so-called Hornbeck-Molnar process. And we measured the thermochemistry of some appearance potentials to get thermochemistry and bond dissociation energies out of that.
Hornbeck?
Molnar, M-O-L-N-A-R.
Okay. And so did Frank have any practical use for this in his ion chemistry studies, or was this just an experiment?
This was just an experiment to see what was going on.
Shake down the experience, see if there's something interesting might be going on that you could capitalize on.
And it didn't occur to us that you could actually make compounds of the rare gases.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not one of the things that even seemed reasonable.
But you were very close to doing it.
Yeah, we made ions.
Yeah, you made ions.
We made
ionic compounds.
We never got around to it. And the rare gases would react with other species because you could make XeCH3 and other species. Again, ions, non-neutral ions. But most of the work really was on reactions of hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
And my recollection of it, and I wasn't involved with the high-level decisions as to how it was that Joe was allowed to do this. To some extent, I think he was allowed to do what it was he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But he convinced the management that the reactions of gaseous ions, gaseous hydrocarbon ions, was relevant to the reactions of acid-catalyzed processes in solution.
Mm-hmm.
So reactions of carbonium or carbenium ions, whichever way you want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Were important.
Mm-hmm.
And they were. They did help in the mechanisms of the processes. So we were then doing reactions in methane, ethane and propane to go back and study what was happening. Because at that time, nobody had any real idea as to what chemical reaction hit rocks. Sorry about that.
Okay.
As to what chemical reactions were going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So you took ethane, increased the pressure, and you got C29 appearing. That was easy, production of that. Propane, you got mass 43. So you've got hydride transfer reactions that were beginning to occur. And I was fine, because hydride transfer reactions were chain transfer reactions in the acid catalyzed processes. So this is going back and seeing them. And you could tell that, lower molecular weight species would abstract the hydride from the higher molecular weight. The lower molecular weight ion would abstract the hydride from a higher molecular weight molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And this fit the thermochemistry and the pattern that was there.
So that was, he was able to at least justify it to management, because they had to do at least that much, but they were willing to support or let him pretty much do what he wanted.
I think that was the case.
Because I don't know how much they must have invested a significant amount of money in the high pressure instrument.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how much it cost. It was done before I got involved with it. But at that time, I'm sure it was expensive. And it took up a whole room. It took up a whole room. Frank moved it to New Jersey when he moved up to New Jersey. And then he took it to Rockefeller.
No. So somewhere along there, the whole business of chemical ionization became a topic.
We did a fair amount of chemistry when the pressures were the order of 0.2 milliliter.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see consecutive ion molecule reactions. If, for example, you took acetylene, which we did, you get ions in acetylene, they will react to produce dimers, which will then react to produce trimers. And you can see these consecutive reactions that were occurring. And then I think it was the year that Frank was on essentially an academic, an industrial sabbatical at Leeds, that Wilburn Giger, who was the technician who really kept that instrument going.
Can I spell his name?
Eiger, I think. It's either E-I or I-E, I don't know.
Okay.
Wilburn and Frank was gone, and so we increased the pressure by another factor of 10.
Mm-hmm.
We took methane and put it in and raised the pressure so we had 2 millimeters of methane. And it took a very long time before we finally managed to figure out what was happening, because we got very irreproducible results.
Mm-hmm.
We got mass 19 and 31 appearing. And mass 19 doesn't belong in methane.
Right.
The reactions of methane were CH4 giving CH5, 16 to 17, and CH3 giving C2H5, 15 to 29, and there were some minor reactions were there. And we periodically saw 19 appearing as a relatively abundant peak at high pressure, and 31 coming and going. And we finally figured out that we had to completely get all of the water out of the instrument to eliminate the mass 19, and there was a little bit of an air leak which gave the mass 31. And then we did, and finally we got the thing to show that if you have going up to high pressure, you get CH5 plus, and it just comes up and flattens out and doesn't react in methane, doesn't do anything at all. And we had no idea what CH5 plus was going to do because it had no known chemistry or anything like that. And then subsequently, Mike Gross with the ICR went back and did it, and you do the ICR is a standard way of doing things because that way you study the kinetics as a function of time.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back, and yes, if you have CH5 plus low pressure methane, it just sort of goes up and doesn't do anything. So people believed that. I don't think they believed our kinetics experiment one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was the case. So we went back, and both CH5 plus and C2H5 plus were essentially inert in methane.
Mm-hmm.
And having discovered the real problem from trace levels of impurities, having very carefully using Phillips research grade methane that had been doubly distilled in a vacuum manifold that hadn't been opened for ages, then we went back and deliberately put small amounts of impurities in, and then you could see the subsequent reactions. CH4 plus coming down, CH5 plus coming up, coming back down again, and the final product coming up.
So your impurity.
Yeah, that was the impurity that you put in. So if you put in a little bit of water in the methane, percent, tenth of a percent, something like that, at 2 millimeters, you could see that you had, by increasing the pressure as you went up, you could see that you had converted 16 to 17 to 19, and then you pick up a little bit of 37.
Mm-hmm.
And at high pressures, the dominant ion was the trace impurity
mm-hmm.
that was there. And we played around with that for a while. And there was another connection. That was around a period of time when radiation chemistry
mm-hmm.
was one of the things of interest. The idea that you would take this stream and put it into a reactor and you'd get all kinds of products. And also, methane was sort of a drug on the market. No one had that much interest in methane. It was flared from the oil refinery. So maybe this was a way of converting methane into something else. So we've been studying high-pressure reactions of methane and put in a bunch of inorganic additives and began putting in other hydrocarbons. And the reaction CH5 plus, after a little bit, it became obvious that CH5 plus was an acid reacting by proton transfer. C2H5 plus was an acid reacting by both proton transfer and hydride transfer, Brunsted and Lewis acid. But CH5 plus was predominantly a proton transfer reagent with a lot of dissociation. Because then you go back and say, all right, if CH5 plus is an acid, CH4 is a base, and the proton affinity was known, but most people don't think of methane as a base. And then we added the other hydrocarbons to it, and we're just sort of unimaginatively putting in different hydrocarbons to see what was happening, because you had no legitimate business for making a prediction as to what the reactions were going to be on there. And we put in isomeric hexanes, because they were available from Phillips Research on it in high purity, and noted that you got similar reactions but different ratios, and put in a couple of other isomeric hydrocarbons. And then what you see is, you had similar reactions but different ratios.
Ratios of
product ions.
Okay.
And the ratios of the product ions were sufficiently different that you could tell the difference between branched and normal hydrocarbons. And you could tell some information about the structure, and that was the beginning of CI.
So that was kind of something you stumbled onto.
Yeah.
By playing with the equipment and then saying, what happens if we stick this in there? And okay. And so there was that famous publication that came out in JAX.
66, I think.
So this, I guess that was ended up being a fairly well referenced publication over the years, I would think.
Yeah.
It was probably the first description of the chemical ionization
process. It was.
But the JAX editors didn't, or someone in JAX.
Did Frank tell you about that?
We didn't talk about it in that great detail.
He's the best, he would be the best one to do it. I say that when I talked about it, he saved the review. I would not have saved the review. If Frank had not been the co-author on the paper, chemical ionization would never have made it. Because the review was very negative about the paper, about the technique, and about everything connected. I don't know who wrote the review. It was obviously one of our senior colleagues in mass spectrometry at the time. I don't know who it was. But it was a short review, very derogatory, all kinds of things. But because Frank was well established and was a very strong character, we made minor changes in the paper, and I think they were minor changes in the paper, resubmitted it, and I think as much as Frank, having influence, it was published.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. But if it hadn't been for that, no, it wouldn't have been published.
I wonder if there was if the reviewers had come from an academic position and kind of figured that these guys in the industry were had no idea what the hell they were doing. And
my guess is it was. I don't really know who it was, but I would guess one of a half a dozen people, because nobody else would be allowed to do it.
Yeah.
And it was not obvious at the time is what it was. And yeah, there were some problems. We couldn't explain all of the peaks that were there. But we could explain most of them.
Mm-hmm. And the major ones.
And we could explain the major ones. And we had what are plausible mechanisms for that. We didn't have verification for the mechanisms. The techniques for verifying those didn't come through until a good deal later on.
Mm-hmm.
But the first paper had a bunch of compounds in it. Actually, the first thing that we did was just to take a series of esters, because we had those.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do that. But that wasn't the first paper, because the first paper was one which had different compounds in it. And the technique was particularly useful for aliphatic esters, because they give a sense of no molecular ion.
Right.
And we could see molecular weight plus one in the products that were there. Alcohols gave some molecular weight plus one, some molecular weight minus one. But you could go back and you could tell, hey, it was obvious that it was an alcohol, and it was obvious that it had this many carbon atoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so actually the technique was useful, and that was what we did. The other thing that was there that came out, that the first papers that we did were with methane.
Mm-hmm.
And methane gave a lot of fragmentation, so you get structural information. We did some with isobutane, because the T-butyl ion, again, T-butyl ion is a much weaker acid, it gets much less decomposition. And that was what the technique was used for a lot at that time, was selective ionization. So you would get one peak per compound, and you would go ahead and do
it. So, how rapidly did the rest of the mass spec community adopt or become interested in this as a method of ionizing compounds?
Not instantaneously. It took a while. I think what helped a lot was when Hank Fales did... Well, one problem was most mass spec... You couldn't do this
in most
mass spectrometers, because you had to go to high pressure.
Right.
And so none of the conventional mass spectrometers at the time could do that. So you had to then rebuild the sources. And AEI, Marvin Vestal, I think, I can't remember what the company was.
We had Vestec.
No, this was well before then.
Well, yeah, another company before Vestec.
No, this wasn't his company. Bill Johnston's company.
ARL or something like that, or... I just finished interviewing Marvin,
that
transcript.
And they built a high-pressure source for the MS-9, and Hank Fales got it. And then Hank began doing showing things on compounds of more interest to more people.
Mm-hmm.
It worked for biological molecules. And then after that, it began to pick up, because you had to have an instrument which could operate at high pressure.
Yeah, it was a serious instrumental issue in terms of getting the technique installed, so to speak, as opposed to fab. I think most people could do fab pretty much pretty easily without a whole lot of modification. So obviously you reported these results at the STM conferences back then. Was there much interest exhibited, or was it primarily just the fundamentals boys that found the and chemistry in the chemical manufacturing?
At the beginning, of course, it was primarily the fundamentalists, because that was the group we talked to.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, with other people starting to use it, it took off. And
because
I recall, I was just coming into the business about that time, that was kind of like a hot topic, the whole idea that you could form ions in a method with other than electron ionization, which had its obvious limitations. and its obvious advantages compared to gas discharge. But the chemical ionization seems to offer an opportunity to study whole ranges of compounds that were beyond, well, like you say, the alcohols, the molecular ion, normally didn't show up, and once you got above, what, C5, C6 alcohol, and here the chemical ionization providing the opportunity to see a lot of the molecular ions.
And I think the other thing that was there that made the technique useful for people is that you could predict the reactions relatively easily with acid-base chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Because you transferred a proton to a place in the molecule, it did its business right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until later on that you came back and you discovered, yeah, you do this and you have reactions occurring. But most of the time, the reactions occurred at that center.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was done about while you guys were still at Humboldt, right?
Yes.
And that was in mid to late 60s.
Yeah.
Okay. And now you said that this was something that you and the technician had worked on while Frank was away on an industrial sabbatical.
Yeah, that was the high pressure of methane. And then when he came back, that was when we started having gotten the high pressure of methane and then going back and putting the impurities.
Was that something he was aware you were going to do, that we were going to increase the pressure by an order of magnitude?
Oh, that was always that was always the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Was the idea that you built an instrument to go up to high pressure, and there's a lot that you could do at 200 microns,
mm-hmm.
and 2,000 microns, it was a factor of 10 in mm-hmm. there, and you could see then more products.
Mm-hmm.
You could see then the
mm-hmm.
multiple reactions, sequential reactions, and more amounts of stuff.
So when he came back, you had already determined that the water, the 19 feet, came from protonating water.
Yeah, it was about that time.
And so he was. This must have been an intriguing idea to him, that what was going on with all this chemistry. Then you say he went to Leeds.
Yeah, he spent a year at Leeds.
Leeds in?
In England.
In England. Okay.
Working, I think, with Michael Henchman.
Okay. He didn't say anything about that in our interview, so I don't know what that was about. So that was, and this industrial sabbatical concept seems like it is another thing that was being done in this industry then that was definitely...
It was not common, but it happened every now and then. Somebody else from the research center, Dave Walker, no connection with mass spectrometry, took off a year and went to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
But
so the operation at Baytown pretty much folded up shortly. SO took over and the whole operation got moved up to...
No, it didn't. It didn't fold.
Oh, okay.
It continued there. There still is a research center that goes on there.
Hmm.
But different parts of it were moved up to the main... What became obviously the main research center at Linden.
Hmm.
And Frank moved up there. Why he moved up there, why it was decided to move him up there, I don't know. That was
mm-hmm.
beyond,
mm-hmm.
that was at a level well above me
mm-hmm.
that I didn't know anything at all about.
So he packed up his gear and took it to New Jersey, and where did you end up in that process?
I was there, and that was about the time I decided I might want to try something else. For a little while after that, I was doing some radiation chemistry experiments, getting the idea of can we take this chemical ionization concept to produce
mm-hmm.
to produce new products. Well, it didn't turn out that way. I don't think it would have ever been successful. But I have recollection. We did some experiments in which we took I think it was tertiary butyl benzene in methane,
mm-hmm.
radiated that in the Van de Graaff generator. Tertiary butylbenzene in nitrogen, and radiated that.
Mm.
And the ion chemistry was very different in methane than it was in nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up getting very different neutral products from that, which suggested again that the ion chemistry did have significant effect
mm-hmm.
on what was going on in it, but nothing ever happened.
So then you stayed at Baytown after Frank had gone to New Jersey.
I think Frank left in 66, and I left in 67. Joe Franklin left in, I think, 63.
Is that when he went to Rice?
He went to Rice. Fred Lamp left the group in, I think it was 62, when he went to Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
Joe left in 63 or 64, something like that, to go to Rice. Frank moved up to Linden in 66, and then I left in 67. That ended the fundamental research in ion chemistry at Baytown.
Mm-hmm.
Mass spectrometry was still going on. Thomas was there, Earl was there.
Okay.
Still doing things.
So when you departed Baytown, you came here?
I came here.
So you've been here for a long time?
I've been here for a long time. I've been here for a long time.
Why did you choose to go into academia?
I think I had always wanted to do that. And 67 was a reasonably good time to be chop hunting in academia. There were opportunities, places that were around that had gone on it. I came to Delaware again. I don't really know why. I like the place. I like the then chair. They had a mass spectrometer. Again, this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And Bill Mosher was the chair, and he'd gotten a grant for a mass spectrometer. And they had the mass spectrometer, and they were looking for somebody to use it.
Mm-hmm.
They had a time of flight, but this was the 110 that they had just gotten, and they were looking for a mass spectrometer.
Hmm.
Mass spectrometers to use it. And I think I came to Delaware because it was what I would describe as a teaching university.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed doing research, but I also really wanted to do teaching in the sort of archaic sense of undergraduate teaching.
Mm.
And that was the opportunity that was here. Now, I didn't really know the difference in standing between the University of Delaware, the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Maryland. I didn't look very carefully at all these things. I didn't look at their rankings and anything like that. I came up here and saw.
Did you look at a variety of schools? Or did
yes.
You chose Delaware from a selection that you had.
I went to, I had offers from Georgia Tech in here. I suspect now most people would be surprised that I took here, but I did.
Well, I mean, given your aversion to cooler climate, I thought you would stay in the South. I mean, you know, Delaware is not Wisconsin, but it is.
No, it's not Wisconsin. I was here, I think I interviewed here over around Christmas, something like that, and it wasn't terribly bad.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been, what, 1960?
I came here in the fall of 67.
67. And you came here as a tenure track position, or did they grant you tenure on arrival? Or
no, I came as an associate professor, but it was a tenure track position. Which is fine, because I think I wouldn't have survived starting out as an assistant professor and doing all the things that were there.
Mm-hmm.
But this was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It was much easier. It was easier to get money. It was easier. You didn't have to document everything. My tenure was granted with minimal fuss. I didn't have to provide 10 books of mm-hmm. this, that, and the other. Now, I don't know why anybody would do it, because the tenure documents are 2 notebooks, 3 notebooks, 4 notebooks, and I really want to insist that the promotion and tenure committees sign a piece of paper saying, I have read these documents. They haven't. I know they haven't. No way.
I have two sons who are in that process now, and one of them, the youngest one, says essentially that the various things that have been added to the process of getting tenure over the years has grown to the point where those that, you know, got it years ago don't quite understand that it's become a real
barrier. It's a monumental process.
So,
ridiculous.
Scott's working on his tenure at Tulane, and Matt's working on his at Northwestern, and it sounds like it's, I guess it'll be worth it eventually, but right now they're really, they're working like crazy, and keeping ridiculous hours, and I guess they'll make it. I hope they make it. So you came in, you wanted to teach when you came here. So what did they assign you to teach?
Teaching freshman chemistry. I taught freshman chemistry. I taught other things, but I taught freshman chemistry nearly every year that I've been here.
Okay. So you must be considered as a very nice person among the faculty to want to teach freshman chemistry. Now, I would assume that a lot of the people aren't interested in dealing with that particular class, and it's probably, what, a large, these large sections?
Yes and no. We do teach a lot of students. We have multiple freshman chemistry courses. Five or six, something like that. They're aimed for different markets. We have a large freshman chemistry course for science and engineering majors, but not chemistry majors, chemistry and chemical engineering. Then we have a course for chemistry and biochemistry and chemical engineering majors. We have another course, a lower level course for people who nominally need some chemistry but don't really like it,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So it's divided an awful lot. And it takes really different skills to do it, because if you're teaching chemistry to students in the College of Nursing, you need to, they're really not interested in quantum numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You need to go back and tailor the course to the market that was there. But I've taught physical chemistry at the undergraduate level. I've taught graduate courses in kinetics, analytical chemistry as well.
And these freshman chemistry classes are, I imagine, fairly large.
Some of them are. For the past 30-odd years, the university developed an honors program in the fall of 1976. And since I had said that I wanted to teach, and I had gone to a small junior college and liked doing that with interactions with students, it figured I should either put up or shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began teaching the honors program in the fall of 1976. And when that program began, it was down in Dover, which is about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove down to Dover two or three days a week and taught classes there. And the classes were smaller, but there was meat. And in fact, for the first 3 years when we were down there, I taught my own labs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had three labs a week in addition to the lecture, the third lab, it was, cool it, kid. I've already heard these. I don't need any of this anymore. But it was fun. It was fun. I enjoyed it. Then the program moved up here in 79, and I had been teaching the honors general chemistry or honors quant, or sometimes both of them, since then.
Mm-hmm. So these honors kids are more serious, I would assume, in their academic pursuits?
Some of them are, but they're still college freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that was interesting was that we learned, well, the program began as an early admissions program.
Mm-hmm.
Students came in, rather than completing their senior year, they took their freshman year in college.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking college courses, and that was fine. And we anticipated that we would have a group that was all highly motivated and all kinds of things like that. And then we discovered that we had a group of freshmen. And that's a special category.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some of them who were really very good and very motivated and all the things that they were. And there were others who were not. And this is characteristic of the young freshmen. They are in general, they're more willing to work, mm-hmm. more interested in doing it. But the course I've been teaching is for chemistry and chemical engineering majors. So these are ones who better want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a modest, or sometimes more than modest, attrition rate as people discover that
this is work.
This is work. I don't really want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm. Because the students now get pushed into things way too early.
Mm-hmm.
And the general, well, not general, but it's frequent. If you're good in math and science, go into engineering. Well, they discover that they really don't like engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And they discover that they don't necessarily like math and science, because the honors group are the ones who did well in essentially everything in high school. And if you do well in things, you like it. Then you discover, I don't really like that.
So I guess the reason the honors program started in Dover was to separate these like pre-freshmen from the rest of the of the college camp or college.
That was part of it, and there was another reason that, again, done at a level beyond me. I think it was an idea that the University of Delaware would then have a somewhat of a presence in Dover, and we were using Wesley College campus, and I don't know whether they needed something or not, but that was it. That was at the presidential level, and I'm not at the presidential level. It was fun, but it was a problem because the students, we offered a whole range of courses, but not necessarily all the courses that they needed, so that the students would be commuting back and forth a couple of days on it. And so in 79, the program moved up here and changed emphasis. It then became no longer an early admission.
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't recruit simultaneously for juniors and seniors.
Right, right, right.
So then it's just an honors program beginning as a freshman year and then gradually extending so that it's a complete honors program over all 4 years now.
And so the qualifications for getting into the program is a grade point average? Or?
It's a grade point average. It's an essay to some extent. It's recommendations. I think the recommendations probably count more than that than they would do in general.
And so how big is the program now? Your entering classes, you were saying the entering class would be, what, about 4,000?
Oh, the entering class at Delaware is about 3,500, something like that. And the honors program has gone up. It's down a bit. I used to pay more attention to what it was. I was director of the honors program for a while. I haven't paid much attention to it. I think maybe at 400
now. Okay, so it's a little bit of a select group.
It is a select group.
So, you had your opportunity to teach. Were you also required to do research? Obviously the mass spectrometer was here, and you were expected to do something with it.
Yeah.
And so,
I had a graduate program.
Okay. So what did you do with your mass spectrometer?
Well, we had two. We have an old time of flight and a new 110. We did some ion chemistry with the time of flight. We were doing, it was a departmental instrument, so it was used for analytical spectra for other faculty, and we had time on it. We're doing research, and so we modified the 110 to go up to high pressures and doing chemical ionization studies with that. And then we got, later on, we got another instrument, an old instrument donated from DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which one it was now, what the number was.
This would have been, mid-70s? Or
something like that. And again, modified and used that, partly for department of use and partly for research in chemical ionization and general ion chemistry.
So the primary thrust of the work here was in the fundamental ion chemistry stuff and chemical ionization.
Yeah.
So your graduate research program, how many students did you end up getting over time?
Oh, somewhere in the 20s.
And these came from, did they come out of Delaware or mostly from other parts of the country?
Mostly from this region. Delaware has been a predominantly regional university.
Mm-hmm.
most of our students come, most of our undergraduates come from the immediate region, more of them from out of state than in state. There are not that many Delawareans who are going to go to graduate school on there. And again, if they come here as an undergraduate, we suggest they go someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a large number of schools on the East Coast. You may
know
there's a large number, a large number of whatever it is. Most of our graduate students at that time came from the schools out here.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten more of an international population now, but still a reasonable fraction of them come. And this weekend, we're hosting here the Intercollegiate Student Chemistry Conference, an undergraduate conference that we've taken undergraduates to for years.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going on for 60 years, maybe, something. I've gone to them for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
On that one. And so this then is, it's not intended, it's not officially intended to be recruiting,
mm-hmm.
but it's a way then of making sure that the small private schools in the Pennsylvania area, and there are a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
know about Delaware, and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are a number of students coming.
And so it's an opportunity for undergraduates to show research? And,
yes, it's an opportunity for the undergraduates to talk about their research, because undergraduates have done research in chemistry for years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Most of the experiences I've had, that's not a common thing, but then it's probably something that's more regional than national, although I think that it's becoming more common in most schools for undergraduates to be involved in research programs. And at least I wasn't, maybe I was, I guess, I didn't think of it as so much as research. So basically, the research that you conducted primarily followed in the lines of the chemical ionization studies.
Yeah, I was continuing what I'd started at Baytown. But Frank and I had started at Baytown.
And were there any significant advances that you came out of that you folks would think were important to the area in terms of the stuff that was done here?
We were trying what I thought was some exotic chemistry. I'm not sure how successful it was. We were doing both exotic chemistry and thermochemistry, trying to get heats of reaction, heats of formation of ions. There were proton affinities. Reactions of, again, trying to get selective reagents.
Mm.
Isobutane is a selective reagent. Well, tetramethylsilane is an analog to that.
Mm-hmm.
And tetramethylsilane is sufficiently volatile. If you put tetramethylsilane in, you get the trimethylsilyl ion. You have to fiddle around with the conditions on that, and you can then use that for selective detection of certain classes
mm-hmm.
of compounds. You can put other reagents in so that you have trimethylsilyl adducts, and you can get a displacement reaction, which increases the selectivity of the process that you're doing. If you use ammonia, and there was the high pressure of ammonia was fine, but there are lots of things it didn't react with because the ammonium ion wasn't much, and the reactions got sort of complicated. And the people at Allied, oh Lord, years ago, discovered accidentally that if you put ammonia in before you use methane, there'll be a little bit of ammonia that's left behind. So you will have then in your reagent gas a mixture of methane ions and ammonium ions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was referred to in a phrase that one better not say these days, Polish ammonia, because the technician who developed it was Polish on it. But it worked fine because you had then both 17, 29, and 18 to react, and you
mm-hmm.
can see the adduct ions for that. And so then we played around with that, trying to work out what were the best conditions, how one did this, and the mechanisms of the reactions that were followed.
So chemical ionization had a reasonable run of application in the broader mass spec community up until probably about the time that Fab came along.
Well, no, it's continued. I don't know that Fab replaced it. It's just that the for a while I sort of kept track. Chemical ionization used to appear in the titles of the papers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't anymore because it's old hat. It's just there. You sort of routinely use it for that, and it's still there.
So the number of people that use chemical ionization is still fairly constant over time.
I don't know. I don't really know. I haven't gone back to look, but I sort of looking at it. There still is. I was looking at what is the Science Citation Index on there, and there are a few thousand papers that have chemical ionization somewhere in the abstract talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
So the technique is still used.
And then this whole business of negative chemical ionization, did you have anything, did you do anything along those lines?
No, unfortunately I never did, because I never had an instrument that would determine negative ions.
Yes. A requirement.
Yeah, Don Hunt was, he wasn't necessarily the first one, but Don did a lot in the negative ion CI.
So, and other than the instruments, that the two that were here when you got here and the one that was donated, where did you end up purchasing other instruments during your tenure as a research mass spec type?
We got a couple of other instruments, but we never, I never built any. We modified them.
Mm-hmm. So a standard operating procedure, I guess, is to operate or modify the instruments after they got here.
Yeah. Yeah. Done some things with Doug Ridge on the ICR, again, mechanisms of CI reactions.
How do you spell his last name?
Ridge, R-I-D-G.
Oh, Ridge. Okay, Ridge. I want to back up a little bit on the, when you were working at ESSO, did you have any issues with publishing in-house? I mean, normally the industrial concerns have to have some kind of vetting of what goes out. Typically, I guess, in my experience, it's kind of a lawyerly issue, but I don't know if when you were at ESSO.
Well, not really, and again, this was sort of the vestigial from Joe Franklin. The work that we were doing was not company confidential of any significance. In fact, yeah, everything had to be approved by the lawyers, but it really wasn't a major problem with that. We never had any difficulties with presenting papers at meetings or submitting things for publication. Chemical ionization was not what they considered a major proprietary. There's a patent on it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. If there was a patent on it, isn't it?
There was a patent. That was my sole patent at Baytown. The company never did anything with it, and it went to SRI, the company that Marvin, Bill Johnson's company, they used it.
So SRI purchased the patent?
From Exxon.
License, or whatever you want to call it. So, as a result, did you get any, was there any financial remuneration to you in terms of the patent? There was anything?
No.
Yeah. So, what's the use of patenting things? So, then you had to obtain your own research funds from when you were here. So, you, NSF or?
Yeah.
Primarily?
I got a grant from the university, has a small fund, and I got a grant from them. I got some funds from the Petroleum Research Foundation, the National Science Foundation, and the NIH over the years.
Mm-hmm. How has that changed over the years?
It's much more difficult to get money. And again, you have to be more specific. To some extent, you do some research to get enough so that you can write the proposal to get the next grant on it. So, I'm uncharitable. I'm not sure that the NIH has ever funded research. I contend that they fund development.
I see.
You have an idea that you're reasonably sure how it's going to come out, and you have to present what you think it's going to be. And the National Science Foundation has gotten more like that over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to get undirected funds that are there, and they need to be tied into this goal or that goal or the other one.
So it's more of getting kind of up towards a development of an application or kind of a highly directed result. The opportunity for serendipity is not very,
it's not as high.
Not very good.
Not very good.
Well, since serendipity accounts for so much in the research world, it's unfortunate that's the way it's working out. So you've had an opportunity to work in both industry and academia, but I think your industrial experience is from an era that no longer exists, so that's hardly any way of comparing it between...
that no longer exists at all.
And what about in your tenure here of, 40 years close to...
Yep, it'll be 43 years.
How has your experience, employment experience in academia, changed over that period? Other than you've become an honored faculty member.
I don't like to say it's become more difficult, but to some extent it has been. Become more legalistic, more of a problem about things. Part of it is reasonable. I suspect all of it's reasonable, but it doesn't make it good. It's going to happen anyway. The safety issues for things. I agree that when I was in graduate school, safety was not one of the things that was even discussed or considered. There, friends and I in graduate school, benzene is a very low-level carcinogen because I'm still alive, and I know some colleagues of mine are still alive. I washed my hands in benzene a few times a week for a couple of years because I was getting rid of polynuclear aromatics, which I knew were worse.
Worse, Chris. That's a good solvent for polynuclear aromatics.
Yes, but the things that we can't do now in the lab, and there's so many things that we can't do in the lab, increasingly... the paperwork, you have to document all of the things that are there. And it just gets to be tedious. I don't know that we're any better off for it, but I don't know that there's anything that's going to happen. I think it's going to go. You have to continue justifying everything it is that you're doing on a continuing basis. There's less and less of a presumption that you actually know what you're doing and you're trying to do it right.
It's somebody watching over your shoulder or helping you watch over your own shoulder to see that it's that you do it right. And yes, well, I hear that and I understand it.
Your sons are likely to be very obvious, very very cognizant of this.
Yes. Well, Scott's in chemistry. Matt's an electrical engineer, physicist. So. But they both do lab work, and you know, so they have to deal with laboratory issues, and it's I don't know. My youngest son at Tulane is concerned about the funding mechanism for research being not supportable over in the coming years. I don't know. He sees the burden of the funding from the government being. It was where primarily almost all funding for research comes these days. It's not being supportable into the future. He thinks it's going to run out of steam. I mean, the number of people doing research, you want money. And the amount of money, I mean, the number of people is going up, the amount of money is going down.
Well, I agree with you.
He's concerned that getting funded is going to become more and more difficult with time.
I agree with him. I think it's going to become more and more difficult at that time because, and the number of sources go down. My objection to the universities is they claim they support research, and they lie. They don't.
They support overhead.
They support overhead. You go out and you get the money and you do the things that will bring it in, and you're supposed to bring in money. If you don't bring in money, you won't get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get retained. And sort of looking at it, if you pay attention to what's done, the government, the different government agencies tend to support things in a particular area that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be working in that area.
So what is the overhead rate here?
I've been out of the research game for a few years.
Okay.
So I know.
But it's, what I imagine it's like 50% or something like that. It's just typically large. Yes. Well, that's an issue.
And if you go back, I'm not sure that there really is a need for the amount of the number of PhDs that we produce. DuPont has cut back. Well, we see things here. DuPont has cut back significantly over the years in the research that it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly development. It's things that are oriented around a particular project. They used to have Central Research Division, used to do lots of things. They don't do that much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
AstraZeneca and the pharmaceutical companies are beginning to cut back, and they're doing things that are there. So I'm not sure that there's a need for that many PhDs to go out that we're doing. And the academic game is based on that.
Mm-hmm.
That you need graduate students to get the work done.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that the United States has as an export, I suppose, is education. I mean, obviously you're aware of the fact that we're educating a large number of foreign students. However many of them stay instead of going back, but there is still that demand and recognition that the United States provides good education for people who want to pursue highly technical fields, and I guess they can always go back to their native country if they can't find.
Yeah. I don't know enough about that as to the ones who go back. Of the ones whom I've seen at Delaware, most of them stayed here rather
mm-hmm.
than going back. And I don't know how the university is trying to develop. Our new president trying to develop more of an international reputation, and so we're getting some foreign undergraduates, and I don't know how that program is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's sardonically amusing that the science and engineering departments have been faulted in the past for foreign graduate students who are teaching labs and the undergraduates cannot understand them.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're supposed to be increasingly diverse and international and so forth and so on. Methinks they talk out of both sides of their mouths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I know that at least at Washington University, the graduate students that come into the chemistry department are almost, I would say, 70-80% from outside the country. I mean, it's a very high percentage of...
We're not that high, but it's increasing. Yeah. It's increasing over the years.
As a matter of fact, one of our faculty members recruits in China. They send him to China for...
We haven't done that yet. And it is a problem because most of the graduate students are supported for a year or two as teaching assistants.
Yes.
And I can, without any problem at all, imagine a student taking a general chemistry lab who isn't either terribly knowledgeable about chemistry or terribly interested in chemistry, having difficulty understanding the lab instructor explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And the universities talk about diversity and all the things that are involved with that. But then we have orientation meetings and all kinds of things for the graduate students. not just for the foreign graduates, but for the graduate students, to make sure that they know what it is that they're doing in the labs and to improve the quality of lab instruction. But we've never done anything useful, I don't know that anybody has, of trying to take advantage of the fact that you do have people coming in from a different culture. It's easy to watch. I go to all my labs. So I know it's easy to tell the difference. The domestic students can talk about things that they did, and that's helpful and useful to the freshmen, to the students. The foreign students aren't comfortable about doing things because their educational experience was very different from what it is here, and they can't talk about what it is that they did with the idea that it's going, or they don't talk about the idea of what they did with in their undergraduate degree as to how it's going to affect the students.
Well, things are changing, that's for sure, and this global economy, global.
Yeah, might as well start to learn new Chinese.
My ability to learn new things is really rapidly diminishing. Now, you've been associated with mass spectrometry since the 60-some-odds, and you've been active in the ASTM E14 organization and ASMS over the years, so... How did you get involved in all that good stuff? Were you kind of drafted or nominated?
The first mass spec meeting that I went to was probably in 63. And I went because neither Joe nor Frank either wanted to go or could go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a meeting in San Francisco. And it was a plum. It was great to go to the meeting, because I think that was probably my first meeting to do that. I can't remember what I talked about, but I think it was Fred Lossing who came up afterwards and talked to me about what it is, about the paper that I had given. And that was one of the things that I noticed about the early mass spec meetings. A collegiality, a geniality, a general interest about them. Then...
They were smaller.
They were much smaller. They were
probably 63, what, maybe 300 or 400?
Yeah, they were much smaller. And only recently they'd gone up to two parallel sessions. Old-timers complained about that because they couldn't go to everything. People had said they couldn't go to everything. And then continued going to the E14 meetings on a fairly regular basis. And then I can't remember when it was that they decided to form ASMS, but I was there at that meeting on that one. And I've gone to most ASMS meetings from then until fairly recently. I don't go anymore. I've essentially stopped research, and I don't like traveling.
So your involvement in the organization began when of ASMS.
I was a charter member of ASMS. I suspect I was nominated for president. Again, because I had been working with Joe. And at those days, if people had heard of you, you had a chance of being elected. If people hadn't heard that much about you, I'm not sure that policy or anything like that for ASMS was one of the things. We ran a meeting, and that was what it was that we were doing.
So somehow your name came up and you were nominated.
I was nominated and I was elected.
Like, this was after it was ASMS, I think.
Yes, this was after it was ASMS.
So that would have been in the, you did the whole 6-year tour, though, didn't you?
Yeah.
You started out for programs.
Yeah, vice president for programs. I was vice president for programs in 79 at the meeting in Seattle. and that was the first time that we had posters.
Mm.
And it was a local mom and pop group that did it. They've had difficulty. At that meeting, I saw every paper that was given.
Mm-hmm.
I heard every paper that was given briefly, because I continued circling around through the entire meeting on there. I didn't hear content of any meeting, mm-hmm. of any talk. I didn't stay to one anyway.
You weren't doing content.
It was just going around looking and making. I was just hyper about it, making sure how things were going to be. Because there was a United Airlines strike just before that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been settled, we would have been in real trouble because people couldn't get to Seattle.
Yeah.
And we had all kinds of things. So Jim McCloskey was president at the time, and we were nervous. about lots of things.
And so, how were the poster sessions at that time?
They were okay, but they said that was our first time to do it, and the lighting wasn't terribly good, and you had to set things up and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
They got better, obviously, as it went on. And there was also the problem at that time that posters were considered second class.
Mm-hmm.
You gave a talk.
Mm-hmm.
Poster.
Mm-hmm.
I changed. I've given a couple of invited talks, but other than that, all my presentations have been posters.
Mm-hmm.
I much prefer posters.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
I contend that if you may have a large audience, hear the talk,
mm-hmm.
but a third of them came to hear the talk before you and are just staying because they don't want to get up and hear you. A third of them came to hear the talk after you, and that's fine. Of the third that came to hear your talk, half of them will decide about halfway through they're not interested in it. So you're talking to a large group, most of the people who are not there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a poster, and my ground rules for posters were I warned people that if they slowed down, I would talk at them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't just have the poster that's there. Those are my slides. Those are my talks with it. And they were fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was exhausted when the days were over because I'd stay there all day talking about the poster.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see some people sort of avoiding me around that they weren't interested. And it was fun. I liked doing that.
Now, I think it has been used wisely by the society, and they do have a good set of guidelines for helping people to put posters together. They've all kind of gone to reduced size overall because of the printing limitations of some of the software. Some of the 4x8 poster boards are kind of not really totally used by most posters.
They
don't get printed out.
And I'm not sure that... Well, it's not going to change. People are going to do it that way, and that's the way it figures. The advantages of the earlier things, putting them up on 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper when you put them together, was that you could prepare your poster, finish your poster the Friday before you left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got to get it done well in advance, and it's sort of hard to make the last minute change.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, there's something wrong on this one. I can change it. But nobody's going to do those anymore.
Well, I have one of these last minute operating persons for one of my sons, and he actually ships or brings his poster on a thumb drive or whatever to the meeting in Government of Ginkgo and has it printed out. You know, at the last minute, so they can get all the changes and stuff done.
Yeah, because that's what you do with the talk now.
Yeah.
Again, it's changed because earlier you were stuck with the slides.
Right.
You couldn't make the last minute changes. It took a while to get the slides prepared. Now you've got your PowerPoint presentation. You can go in and you can edit it. The morning that you give the talk.
It's kind of like they say it's changed between your posters you had to be prepared ahead of time. And, now, I guess in the old days you had to have your slides done. I mean, obviously, at McDonnell Douglas when I was working there, everything had to be done by their group, the technical art people, and they took art. They did all the art work and they produced the slides, the whole nine yards. So it was a big deal. You had to get it in plenty early so you could get it set.
Well, when I came here, we didn't have any good way of doing it. So you had to get your slides ready and take them to a commercial place to get them done. And, yeah, they could get them done overnight, maybe.
So when did you sign off on the research into things?
Trying to remember exactly when. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I've been threatening to retire for 10 years. I will retire one of these years or die. I'm not sure which. And graduate students are a commitment of 4 or 5 years. And I wasn't really sure that I was going to stay that long. So I just sort of got out of the game.
And did someone else take over the mass spec operation here?
Well, we've had multiple mass spec groups. That were
okay.
For a while, we had Gene and his group.
Cottrell. Okay.
Group, me and my group. Doug Ridge and his group. And Murray Johnson and his group. We had a lot of mass spectrometry going on here. Gene left, I stopped, so we have Doug and Murray who are still doing the mass spectrometry that's there. So, yeah, mass spectrometry is still going on, I'm just not involved with it.
When did Gene come here, Futrell? He was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for a while, I think.
He was at Wright-Patterson, and then he was at Utah. He came here from Utah.
Oh, okay, he went to Utah.
He came as the department chair. Now, when did he come? That is a good question, the answer to which I don't know. He was the chair after Wetlaufer. Okay, but that doesn't really do any good. Wetlaufer was chair from 75 to 80 something, and then Gene probably came in the late 80s, maybe.
Okay. 20 years ago or so.
Yeah, and he was here for 10, 15 years.
Now he brought a research group with him from Utah with equipment.
Yeah.
And so he's always interested in MSMS type things, collision-induced association stuff.
Yeah.
He carried all that stuff on.
He brought his attention.
Did you guys collaborate on anything or any projects?
We didn't collaborate on any papers. We had one of these National Science Foundation, multidisciplinary industry university programs that Gene sort of got organized on that. But we're not co-authors on any paper. I was on committees of his students and vice versa.
So it seems like coming in as department chair doesn't give you much time to do research. Or is this, kind of a low-level department chair job?
I'm not department chair.
No, but I mean Futrell. You say he came in as department chair?
Yeah. He came in as department chair. But he had Anil Shukla as a postdoc. And so he had his group was going on. It wasn't huge. Mass spectrometry groups are not huge because you're sort of instrument limited.
Yeah.
And he continued to build, and he was here for 10 years, 10 or 12 years, before he went out to the Tail Northwest.
So was he chair during that whole period, or
yeah? Yeah.
Okay, so I mean
he was chair for 2 5-year terms.
Okay. So, I mean, that's typically the job of a department chair is not looked upon as something you want to get involved in.
No, but Gene liked administration. He liked it.
Okay, I guess so. If you like it, it's it works okay. And then, he's still at Patel, I think, in Northwest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that he was up here. And, you've seen a lot in the mass spec business. what do you think about the recent developments, I guess they're recent, about the last 10 years, 15 years, of these new ionization techniques that open up the world of biology?
I think John Fenn deserved his Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Because the electrospray is so different from every other kind of ion formation. All of the others, the fast atom bombardment, the fission fragment, CI, FI, FD, all consist of taking something and producing the ions from the neutral species.
Mm-hmm.
In electrospray, you start out with the ions and you get rid of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a tremendous difference in the way of thinking about things. I don't know if you were talking, I don't know, Marvin's
thermal spray
was relatively close. And I don't know whether Marvin feels aggrieved that...
Not really. We talked about that a couple of months ago. And... he thinks it's great, you know, that the electrospray came along and superseded his technology.
Yeah.
So even though, I mean, it displaced his company, but, you know, I mean, Marvin is not one to worry about the past. He's ready to move on to the future.
Okay. But though the thermospray was the only thing that was even remotely close,
mm-hmm.
because the electrospray was just discontinuously different
mm-hmm.
from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it has certainly tremendously changed mass spectrometry. I can remember Catherine had a paper in analytical chemistry many years ago, 20 years ago, something like that, if I talk about middle molecule,
mm-hmm.
AMH,
yeah.
middle
yeah,
molecule
I remember
mass
that.
Spectrometry.
Yeah.
And middle molecules were a couple of thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the thing, and at that time, getting up to molecular weights of a couple of thousand, that was a heroic effort.
Yes.
That was a heroic effort. And just Hank failed to have some things, some fluorinated polymers
mm-hmm.
that were used, it would be mass range in there. But it was just a formidable task to get up there. And now, you can do whatever it is that you want.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty amazing. The other thing I find truly strange or amazing is the phoenix-like rise from the ashes of time-of-flight mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there was a time-of-flight instrument here, which when he came here, which was a Bendix machine,
yep.
I'm pretty sure.
Yep.
And
there was no other kind.
Yeah, that was it. And its performance, mass spec-wise, was certainly nothing to
no,
be...
It has a mass range of about 250, something like that. And one of my first graduate students and I hooked it up to a GC.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you could get the fast spectrum. So GC, CIMS, not terribly practical, not terribly good,
mm-hmm.
but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And you could show that you could do GC, CIMS
mm-hmm.
that way. But, yeah, the time of flight since then has just improved tremendously. Well, same way with the magnetic instruments. When we had the 110, it was intended for photographic plates,
mm-hmm.
but the photoplate reader cost $50,000,
mm-hmm.
and we never had a photoplate reader, so we always used it for electrical recording.
Mm-hmm.
And the magnet was slow, and in order to go back and do things, you had to recycle a magnet, you had to cover a certain range, and so forth and so on. And when our electronics and I put a computer on it, we would have it set up so that it would scan for, you'd have it cycle for a while, and not a short time,
mm-hmm.
but cycle for a while so that you could go back then and get it to cover the, get reproducibility for what you wanted.
Mm-hmm. And so you actually end up having your own computer MS hookup done here with local talent, that kind of thing. Yeah, the time of flight thing, I guess the reflectron is one of the things that moved it forward in terms of resolving power. And then the electronics have evolved to the point where they can get the kind of and sizes of pulses, they need the iron source to make it work.
Well, and the same way for the quadrupoles. The quadrupoles initially were a GC instrument because they would go up to 250 or 400, something like that, but they scanned fast.
Mm-hmm.
And how you can get quadrupoles?
Up in the thousands range.
Yeah.
So what do you think about biology taking over mass spectrometry?
I'm not in that part of it. It was sort of looking at it, that the ASM, you see it in the ASMS meeting, because so much of it is biological applications. For those of us been around for a while, the physical organic chemists were taking it over for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamentalists are there, and they're still there, but it's the decreasing fraction
mm-hmm.
of the group, and we were always concerned as to whether or not they were going to go form their own splinter group.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent they have, but they're still fundamentalists that are there. The physical organic were in there for a while, and then the
environmentalists, the
metabolites.
Mm-hmm.
Going back, GCMS for the GCMS for the metabolites, but then the complete burgeoning of things in high molecular weight and biological systems that are there. I don't do it. I never did
mm-hmm.
do that. I have no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I understand its practicality and utility, but I like small enough molecules that I can see and sort of think of them as adding pieces.
I'd like to just kind of touch base on some of your personal interactions with individuals that established themselves in the field. And so I don't know how much interaction you had with John Bynum during your career.
I met John Bynum and visited with him on several occasions at ASMS meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there have been a few cases where he and Fred Lossing and I would sort of go out and take an afternoon off for the mass spec meetings. I enjoyed meeting John. I used to have his book, and I recommended his book to everybody because that first book was absolutely one of the best things that was written about mass spectrometry, with the fundamentals and details of things that were there. I enjoyed very much knowing John.
The table of mass spectral accurate mass in the back. Apparently he calculated all those, and his wife checked them by hand.
Okay, that I would believe. That I would believe.
Which is a pretty amazing feat. But it's a classic, and it's a book to make sure you've got on your bookshelf if you're in a mass spec. But what about Klaus Biemann?
I never knew that Klaus in recent years, and when he was more active, I didn't really know him because we were working in different areas on it. The fundamentals, I attended the fundamental section,
mm-hmm.
The ion chemistry, thermochemistry, and so forth, so I didn't really know Klaus at all.
Of course, we've talked about Joe Franklin. Unfortunately, Joe really, it's unfortunate we don't have an opportunity to talk to him in today, but I think through individuals like yourself, we get some insight into his character, personality, and importance.
I think he was very important, certainly in ion chemistry and mass spectrometry in general. He was the second president, or the first?
For ASMS?
Yes.
I've got the records. He was in the early, he was in one of the early.
He was certainly one of the instigators in forming the society, and he had a major influence over the things. And he was a very good friend. He was a very good friend and a mentor to me. My mass spectrometry came from him.
Mm-hmm.
Came from him and Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very gracious host. He was a good cook.
Oh, really?
He was a very good cook. He wasn't, last year he wasn't allowed in the lab.
I was wondering if he during your time of tenure there at Humboldt if he was a hands-on kind of guy, or was he like a management level?
He was at management level, and even hadn't been at management level. I think he'd been in the middle now.
Okay.
He had ideas to help you, and he wasn't a dominating personality. It wasn't that you do this, mm-hmm. you do that, you do the other. He was a very good mentor.
So just by the process of an interaction on a scientific problem, he kind of guided it, but he didn't.
He didn't direct it.
He didn't say, this is what we need to do.
No,
it kind of helped you see that that was the way that you needed to go. Yeah, Frank Fields spoke very highly of Joe Franklin, and as a super individual.
He was very much, and. After I moved up here and he was at Rice, I would come down and I would generally meet them once a year, a couple of times a year, something like that when I was down. And we would go out to dinner. We would eat. We were eating our way through the restaurant in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
Joe was a gourmet cook,
mm-hmm.
and he enjoyed his food and knew all about it, and he was well let on there. And it was interesting because we would go out and I would be telling the waiter what to do, all the things, check, so forth and so on, so that it was obvious to anybody that I was the host,
mm-hmm.
that Joe got the check. I managed to get the check back frequently, but Joe got the check on that. And we took a couple of long trips. Went out to one Asmus meeting,
mm-hmm.
and then drove up the California coast to Canada.
Oh, wow.
On that one. And it was fun. I enjoyed that.
So, why did he leave, when he left Humboldt to go to Rice? I mean, was he sought by Rice?
Yes.
So they wanted him.
They wanted him. He went as the first Welsh professor mm-hmm. at Rice. Mm-hmm.
And
set up a lab for him there.
So do you recall what the kinds of things he was doing at that with the lab there?
Iron chemistry.
That's more iron chemistry stuff.
Iron chemistry. Yeah. That's what he was doing.
Now at the time, I guess Rice has always been a fairly prestigious institution. It was probably much smaller than, I guess, but it was an important school.
It was smaller than. I don't think, I'm not sure the Rice has grown that much in size. Mm-hmm. It was a private school always. Mm-hmm. And, they've sort of diversified, I think, over the years. It initially was Rice Institute.
Right.
Primarily science and technology. I think they've expanded. Called themselves Rice University, but I think it's still Rice Institute.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they went to get Joe.
And unfortunately, he didn't have a very long tenure there before he died. I mean, he died kind of young in age.
I can find that because I have something on Joe. I think I have something on Joe.
82. So, I guess he was there for...
He's right for 10 years.
10 years, okay.
Oh, no longer than that. 20 years. Because he went to Rice... He went to Rice in 63.
Ah, okay.
He was the chairman for probably... 5 to 10 years, something like that.
Is it possible I can have rocks on that? Because I think it's valuable information. That he's an important person, and we don't have anything like this about his. This would be great. Yeah, we'll try and get a copy of that. Does he have a file on Joe?
Mm-hmm.
You have any good pictures besides the...
That's the standard picture.
Yeah.
He liked that. I can't remember the name of the there was a photographer in Houston who took standard pictures like that.
Yeah, that'd be great to have some, you know, something to document is get that file with CHF or...
Yeah, I was looking at this. This was correspondent it was a Seattle meeting, I guess, 79. So after the meeting, we went up into Canada, Kamloops. Joe and Mildred made the arrangements, and I did the driving on that. And they were great fun. And Mildred also was very congenial, very helpful.
And the pair of them did all the things that you would think.
Mm-hmm.
They routinely had dinners. They would invite people over, graduate students,
mm-hmm.
postdocs, visiting faculty,
mm-hmm.
and what have you.
Of course, you mentioned Earl Lufkin, but then Earl was primarily involved in the analytical side of the lab there.
Yeah. Earl and Tom were there developing analytical procedures, and practically all analytical chemistry as such,
mm-hmm.
but some interesting things that were done in that group. I don't know whether Earl is still alive or not.
I'm not sure. If he is, he's living in Round Rock, north of Boston.
I haven't seen him in a long time.
Yeah. Henry Rosenstock.
I knew Henry slightly, again through ASMS and
mm-hmm.
through Joe.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about it.
So they were doing somewhere that Rosenstock was at the National Bureau of Standards doing these fundamental studies and appearance potential and that kind of thing.
And some calculations of rate constants of reactions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. O.P. Tanner, did you have any interactions much with O.P.? He worked at Monsanto.
I don't recall him at all.
We had actually OP's the guy that got me involved in the field and took me to my first ASTM conference. That was fun out in Dallas. And of course, we talked about Frank Field, his interaction with Frank. So he was kind of a mentor for you as well as...
Yes, he was.
As Frank
was. I said I started out to contend that was Joe's first postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was a junior colleague with Frank, but I was a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But Joe's definition, I was a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, I was his first postdoc.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like the group that and chemistry group kind of dissipated, I guess, pretty much about the time Franklin left first, right? And then
he left in 63, Frank left in 66, I left in 67.
So it was just a kind of a gradual evaporation of the of the troops.
Oh, of course, the other interesting thing was that Gene Chutrel was in Baytown.
Oh.
For a while.
Oh, okay.
For a year or two, maybe.
Okay. So I wasn't aware of that. So he was, did you have any interaction with him then? Or he was off doing something different, I suppose.
I didn't. Yeah, I think he was there before he went to wherever it was in Ohio.
Mm. Wright-Patterson.
Wright-Patterson.
Yeah.
I think he was there because he did have a connection. I think he had to have been there for a short in radiation chemistry
mm-hmm.
for a short period of time.
You mentioned Marvin Bethel. Did you have any interactions with him in any way?
When Marvin was at, I think it was SRI in Baltimore, I went down and sort of consulted briefly with them because we had made a... they were designing the source of the MS-9, and we built a high pressure source, made a high pressure source, and something like that. And then I kept up with Marvin over the years. He's just a delightful person.
He's a very energetic fellow.
Very much so.
And full of ideas.
Now, he has an interesting history.
Oh, I know. I just had with him for a day, and he's he was he's being granted patents even as we sit here on his ideas about how we're going to revolutionize the proteomics business, and his vision is one that he holds dearly and is promoting and working hard to make happen. So it'll be interesting to see in a year how things turn up. Okay, what other ideas and things do we have to talk about here? What would you consider your most significant publication out of everything that you've done?
Well, I guess I'd better consider the first CI papers the most significant publication.
I guess that probably kind of puts you on the map amongst a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we got pretty well. Did you ever keep track of the number of reprint requests you got for it, or did you run out of it?
No, I ran out of
that.
Yeah.
That was back in the days when you had sent postcards and it sent them off to people all over the place, and it was kind of fun. Nowadays, everything is online before you can hardly get it, out of your lab. Okay, well, I think we can take a break here. I'd like to do a little bit of video recording. Is there anything else that you want to, words of wisdom that you want to bestow on us while we're
entirely
at it?
You're in charge of this. I'm just here.
Okay, well, I've kind of, basically, we've talked about your experiences in industry and academia, and we've kind of reviewed the differences that have occurred over that period of time. It's interesting how things have changed, and it's hard to see them ever change back, that's for sure.
No, they won't change back.
You never really had to do any research management in an industrial environment, and most of what you've done academically has been in mentoring graduate students.
I was chair of the department for a while, didn't like it.
Yeah.
Director of the honors program for a while, and gave that up when I had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. I understand you have something of a connection to Texas. You go back there regularly?
Yeah. I'll put on my best Southeast Texas accent.
So, is the plan to retire to Texas, or?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's another one of these.
It gets life more complicated. As I said, I've been threatening to retire for about 10 years now, and I'm going to have to in a bit, because I'm tired. I can't do the things that I've been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to decide whether I'm going to stay here or whether I'm going to go down to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trivial thing, but I've lived in Delaware longer than I've lived any place else.
Mm-hmm.
But I've really never paid much attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Since I don't have a family, I haven't been involved in things. My connection with Delaware is through the university,
mm-hmm.
and over the years through the honors program. So these are the people whom I know,
mm-hmm.
and they're here. I'm not really planning to join a retirement community to do anything
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the house down in Texas, and I have friends down in Texas. But the problem down there, the house is fine, and it's a small town, and I get around there. But the friends whom I visit don't live terribly close.
Mm-hmm.
And realism sets in every now and then. And I don't know how much longer I can drive 300 miles
mm-hmm.
or how much. I should do these things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind killing myself, but I don't want to kill anybody else
mm-hmm.
on that. So I don't know. I've had more connections with the medical profession in the past 5 or 6 years than I ever wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I like my doctors up here, and I don't really want to change to go down there. But I don't know what I'm going to do. A colleague retired from here to the Houston area some time back, and his comment was, you don't have to shovel heat.
Yes.
And that's true.
So whereabouts in Texas is this property that you have? Is it
southwest of Houston.
Okay.
Fort. It's my father's house.
So you're getting close to the Gulf again. South.
Yeah, south. It's nominally the Texas Gulf Coast. It's not close enough to the coast doesn't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
When I came through, we were sufficiently far from the coast that there wasn't good. It would be wind damage, and wind damage is generally minimal.
Mm-hmm.
It's really outrageous.
Mm-hmm. So that's something to be decided in the future.
Yeah. And I don't have time.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do at this point is maybe take a little break and then do a short video talking
okay.
about some specific topics, and then
I'd
like to pick your files for any pictures that you might have that would be interesting to put up. Let me see if I can stop my